Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. On our way to our conversation, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Hospital for Children, offering primary, specialty, and critical care for all children, from the smallest babies to the biggest teenagers. For more information or to learn about their specialty outpatient locations throughout the state, 1-800-492-5538. Or you can go to steinershow.org and click on the University of Maryland Medical System banner, and all the information is there as well. The other day I got an email from an old friend who is also a frequent guest on the show. Every month he comes and joins us to talk about addiction and many other things. Woody Curry, who is clinical and associate executive director of the Baltimore Station, and saying that a new report came out from the American Society for Addiction Medicine that said addiction is a brain disease. Disorder. And Woody, for years, has been saying this, preaching this, discussing it, studying it, and using that model in his work with addicts at the Baltimore Station. So he joins us here in the studio, and joining us by phone is Dr. Michael Miller, who is past president of the American Society for Addiction Medicine, part of this study, and is medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at the Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. Did I say that right?
Oh, that was a nice effort. Oconomowoc.
Oconomowoc. Okay, gotcha. Well, welcome, Dr. Michael Miller. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
So, and folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, as this conversation unfolds with your own thoughts on this. So talk first, Dr. Michael Miller, about, and Woody, jump in with all your thoughts and questions as well for this first half of the show, about what the significance of this is and why it transpired now.
Well, the significance of this is that we have heretofore really focused on the outward behaviors of people who have addiction. That's how we really see that something is amiss, is they're not meeting their responsibilities, they may be getting intoxicated frequently, they're doing things that really aren't very helpful to them and very hurtful to people around them. And most of the diagnostic criteria have really focused on, well, let's just see what behavior is the patient showing. And, you know, this sort of becomes a metaphor that says addiction is people behaving badly. And that's not really what addiction is. Addiction is a terrible illness that people do not ask for. It's not a desired condition. It's a potentially fatal condition. And the reason people have this behavior that people see on the outside is what's happening on the inside. We've learned through research over the last 15 years, stuff that's come from the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, the National Institute of Drug Abuse in D.C., that the brains of people who have addiction are really functioning differently than the brains of people who don't have addiction. The genetics is a big factor here. And so what the American Society of Addiction Medicine wanted to do was to try to pull together what we've learned and try to make sense of it, be able to describe it to physicians who are our members and to other physicians who might be interested in addiction, to anybody who has a patient or a family member who has this problem, to really help understand what's happening with these different parts of the brain that involve reward, memory, motivation, emotions, etc. So that's kind of what it's about.
And Woody, I mean, this is, I want you to talk a bit about your approach. I mean, this is something that we've talked about for years in the time we've known each other. And you've been arguing this for a long time, this particular idea.
I wasn't arguing. It's just that people didn't see it.
Right.
What happened was I've been following the research that Dr. Miller's talking about, and I get the NIDA journals and from NIH and from American Alcoholism, and I read all of that, and looking at brain structure and understanding how the brain works and how these different drugs and the drugs that the endogenous ones, the ones that the body produces, how that changes affect, feeling, moods, behavior, different things like that. Stuff is internally motivated. It may be the stimuli may come from the environment, but the reaction is on the inside. And if the brain is not processing correctly or dysfunctional in a sense, because of this, then you're going to see aberrant and abnormal types of behavior, abnormal reactions in people. So I had been looking at this for quite some time and following this research and got down to looking really at brain structure, the amygdala, especially the mesolimbic system, the psychoneuroimmunological system. I hate to use all these big terms, but that's all affected by different changes in chemicals in the brain and the response. And it just led me to look at maybe, and then understanding latest findings like neuroplasticity, the ability, neuroadaptation, how neurons and things can change and adapt, and you can practice learning new behaviors and, put simplistically, almost rewire the brain. And that led me to different types of clinical applications that's already out there, interventions to address certain symptoms that people exhibit and things like that. But understanding that the primary genesis of it was in the way the brain was functioning and processing information. I was saying one time, I think I told you, that those drugs give the brain, it sent a false message. It makes the person feel as though he's okay in light of all of the other stuff. And these behaviors are products of automaticity, habituation, different things like that, features that you see in addiction. And that's what I have been basing the treatment on and extending the treatment over a 2-year period of time, because it's memory and learned behavior.
So, I'm sorry.
And basically, that's simplistically what we do. But we do it systematically over an extended period of time, and it's a therapeutic community model, so it's a 24/7 kind of interaction that you see with the guys that we have.
So, Michael Miller, there are a couple of things here. I think that I'm curious from your perspective how you think this could change, possibly change, our approach to addiction, not our understanding of addiction, but also our approach to how to confronting it and treating it.
Well, one of the traditions in our country is to view people with addiction as being bad people, to stigmatize them, and oftentimes to think that they've brought this on themselves and this is something that they want. The Supreme Court has even used the term willful misconduct willful misconduct. And so it focuses on bad conduct and bad choices. And so there's been a lot of stigma surrounding addiction for a long time. And I think what this can do is help people understand really the way that substance use and exposure to other rewards for people who have addiction involves a hijacking of the brain's motivational system. It involves changes, as our other guest has talked about, in the in memory circuits and response patterns. And a real difference in addiction is cue response. People without this cue responsiveness don't respond to triggers the way people with addiction respond. And some of the treatments involve really looking at cue response and changing the way we do respond to various people, places, and things in our environment. So I think this opens up lots of possibilities for using psychotherapeutic techniques, interpersonal techniques, as well as pharmacological techniques and psychological techniques to address these things that are actually wrong with the brain of the person who has addiction. This is not just about saying that it's only the brain and only the body and we only need medication solutions. That's not what this is about. But it does open up the possibility that new medication development will be one of the helpful things, along with psychotherapies and other interventions, to help people get their lives back on track.
So I wonder what, just as you were describing that, both of you want to ask this question, and start with Michael Miller and go to Woody Curry. What effect could this study have on, and what does it say about, the use of methadone, the use of buprenorphine, and other drugs to try to stop the desire for addiction, I mean, the desire for the drugs. So, I mean, I wonder how this challenges those forms of treatment how that changes the conversation.
Well, certainly we all know that there's been a long tradition of psychosocial therapies that had their sort of roots in the 12-step model of AA. And a lot of people have had an orientation that says that you should take all chemicals out of your body and shouldn't put any chemicals into your body. And so medication treatment, like taking a drug to treat drug addiction, is just iconoclastic. We just can't go there. And certainly the medications you mentioned can be very helpful to a number of patients who have opioid addiction. And there are other medications for nicotine addiction and alcohol addiction. And in the future, there will be medications for cocaine addiction and cannabis dependence and all sorts of things. So certainly it opens up those possibilities. But the fundamental issues in this new description by ASAM is actually that addiction isn't about drugs at all. It's about brains. And addiction can happen in people who haven't lost control with alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, or morphine. Maybe they've lost control with certain behaviors that are very reinforcing for them, with gambling, with certain sexual pursuits, with certain eating pursuits. And so the focus should not necessarily be on what drug you're addicted to or what medication you take to change that, but let's understand, as Woody has said, what's happened with neuroplasticity. How has your brain changed? It's not about drugs. It's about how your brain responds to those drugs. I would say the general statistics are that two-thirds of Americans consume alcohol.
Right.
It doesn't mean that two-thirds of Americans have alcoholism. Addiction only happens in about 10% of those. So most people can expose themselves to drugs, alcohol, even cocaine, Valium, cannabis, without developing addiction. It's not demonizing the drug. It's let's look at how in certain patients with certain genetic vulnerabilities and other vulnerabilities, when they do expose themselves to these rewards, you end up with what this definition describes, the pathological pursuit of reward. And that's what the disorder is.
That's exactly what I've been seeing and doing all along, saying that drugs are just a symptom of a much more fundamental problem, but nobody saw that until recently. The research has been pointing at it all along, but it just recently established a systematic way that it connects and how the whole body is a unit. It's not compartmentalized like brain here, stomach here, or this, that, and the other. A change in one part changes basically everything, one way or the other. And
absolutely.
It's looking.
Now, Woody and I don't know each other.
Right.
We've never met each other, never heard of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are singing like a duet act, in harmony here on the same themes. And what has he said? He said he runs a therapeutic community where people are intensively involved in change for 2 years.
Right.
He has said that he looks at the whole person, biopsychosocial, spiritual, and doesn't get caught up in drug this or drug that, but looks at, who are you? How are you connected to other people? How are you connected to that which transcends human experience? Where are you in your life? And what this definition does is it says that there is a chronic disease. It's a biopsychosocial spiritual condition. It's chronic, and it takes time to change, and you need to help people over a period of time and not think that 28 days is going to change their lives or 10 visits with the therapist is going to change their lives. It takes intensity, it takes duration, and treatment is very effective when it comes in the proper dose and duration. Now, this came out of a consensus at the American Society of Addiction Medicine. These are things that Woody has learned through
mm-hmm.
his experience and has been sharing on this radio program for a period of time. So
yes.
I'm delighted to be a guest of yours today.
Well, and I think that as you were describing that, and as I was listening to in my head, was I was hearing insurance companies saying, no, we're not going to pay for this, but we'll pay for methadone. We'll give you this drug. We'll do whatever we can to get you in a 28-day program and get you back in the street and the community and back to your family. I mean, this is for this to be wrestled with seriously would change the entire nature of how we treat all kinds of addiction from alcohol to gambling to chocolate.
Well, we found a way, my organization has found a cost-effective way of doing this. With the therapeutic community, the onus is on the clients themselves to adapt and change their behavior and their lifestyle and their attitude. most of the – we're given the right amount of information, given information that's relevant, given information that works, and people can see that some changes start to occur in their lives, they become engaged in the process themselves. So it's really actually the clients that I have themselves that's doing all of this, pointed in the right direction, given the right kind of reinforcement, given the right kind of education, given the right kind of respect and dignity that a person deserves. You'd be surprised how many people will engage in a process that they believe and that they see will work for them and effect some changes in their lives that heretofore they just haven't been able to effect or to do.
But what do you both see? I mean, after this has come out, I've already seen some articles that are not disagreeing with what has been discovered, what has been maintained in this new report, but are saying things like, well, look, the majority of people who are addicted come out of it on their own. They don't go into programs. They don't need programs. One article was quoting a study that took place in 2005 that said that, I could see where this could cause a lot of controversy over treatment and with programs, especially who are treating people for all kinds of addictions in very different ways than this report purports should be done. I mean, I can see that. Let me go to Mike. So we only have a few minutes left with Michael Miller. Let me start with him and then go to Woody. Michael?
Well, yeah. There's a lot of different ways of looking at substance use and other behaviors that seem to be related to addiction. And there's a spectrum of quantity and frequency of substance use and a spectrum of impairment. And people, quote-unquote, recover from problematic substance use spontaneously. That's definitely the case. And I think, definitions are really important. And we're talking here in this new definition of addiction from ASAM about addiction, again, not being about drugs, but being about brains, and we're talking about a process that is not based on quantity or frequency of drug use, but is based on what happens to you when you expose yourself to these rewards, some of which are alcohol and drugs. So spontaneous remission occurs from certain things. But the spontaneous remission occur from this very complex brain condition that involves all these different brain circuits of motivation and memory and impulse control and judgment and drive and selection of one behavior versus another. And, we really haven't done research on addiction as it's described in this paper. To say what are the spontaneous recovery rates from that. And what this paper asserts is that you get your best results with a combination of self-help, self-care, and professional services. You don't have to take medication, but sometimes medications can be helpful. And, there's always going to be naysayers. There's always going to be people that say, oh, you have some vested interest or some axe you're trying to grind. And that's some of the stuff from the blogosphere that I think you're referencing here. But people do get well without professional help. That does happen. And even with addiction as described here, I think through a really intense program of personal change, I think it might happen. But it all depends on, are you talking apples and oranges? And we're not talking here about heavy drinking. We're not talking here about heavy tobacco use. We're not talking here about quantity frequency of drug use. We're talking about a very complex biopsychosocial spiritual condition that involves different brain areas that are interacting with each other and that change their functioning when certain individuals expose themselves to rewards repeatedly. And these terms we're using may sound like $20 words and all the anatomy terms and physiology terms that Woody was, talking about may sound like $50 words. We're not trying to confuse anybody. We're, in fact, trying to take this complex information mm-hmm. and make it somewhat understandable. And people can find this on www.asam.org, which is our website for the American Society of Addiction Medicine. But, you know, we're not trying to make a political statement here. We're not trying to make an economic statement here. We're trying to help doctors and patients understand something about this fascinating biology that we have learned more about from the discoveries of the last, you know, couple of decades.
Go ahead, Woody.
I would like for you, Michael, or Mark, to talk to some of the residents that I have that have been there for a while. And they will tell you, yeah, I have an addiction, but I have a brain disorder. And then they can go on to describe in terms that they understand just what we're talking about. When Dr. Miller said about the words, I have to use them to, you know, that's my understanding, but I have to be able to break those things down into some behavioral experience context that the people that I'm treating have had or experienced so that they can connect and so it becomes relevant. So I have a way of explaining these things in the context of the addict's personal experience with life, the feelings, his motivations, his belief, everything. You have to engage and see this. And they come to a different understanding about themselves as a result of that, because we're talking about people, you see, and human beings. And we all are human. And this condition affects a few people, but actually, we are hardwired for addiction. Human beings are. I mean, and then the way we operate, any behavior that's rewarded, you can expect it to continue. In fact, that's what we do as human beings. We reward behaviors that we want to see continue. You want to get paid, you go to work every day. You know, you reward. And that reward system's been hijacked by a chemical where you get the reward without actually doing anything to get it. When Dr. Miller mentioned earlier about the brain being hijacked, I just did a group today on that, and I said what drugs provide is a false message to the brain. It tells you that you're okay when everything around you really isn't. That's why logic and arguments and reasoning, it doesn't work with a person that's really in active addiction, because he's operating from his own context, his own feeling experience. And what you're saying might make sense, but it doesn't change where he is as far as his feelings and what he needs is concerned. You see, so it's a little bit more complex than mm-hmm. just
Michael
looking Miller, at the drug use.
Michael Miller, go ahead.
Yeah. Are we gonna take a break or just go right straight on through?
We are going to take a break in a few minutes, but don't you have to leave in a few minutes? Can you stay with us for a while?
Well, no. What I was going to comment on, Woody runs a program where people can stay for a couple of years in a residential setting and really change themselves, become almost a new self again. And it's a rebirth process. I'm familiar with therapeutic communities and have a tremendous amount of respect for them. But what he said was, listen to these residents, listen to these patients, listen to these recovering people, and let them tell you from their experience what they've gone through. And what happened here is that the American Society of Addiction Medicine is an organization of 3,000 physicians from around the country who really care about prevention and treatment and recovery and education regarding these conditions. And we're largely clinicians. We got researchers, we got teachers, we got policy people, but we're largely doctors that take care of patients. You learn the most not from the textbook, but from your patient. And the things that are described in this definition ring true for patients. They tell you what it's like for them. They tell you what it's like as they're going down the slope of addiction. They tell you as they're coming up through recovery. And so, one of the features that has been talked about for decades about what addiction is, especially to alcohol and drugs, is this impairment in control, that you plan to use a certain amount and you find out, wait a minute, I ended up having a very different outcome than what I planned. I wasn't planning on doing this. I lost control. Now, only 10% of the public has addiction to alcohol and other drugs. Only 10%. 90% don't. So for most people, the concept of impaired control is counterintuitive. It's like, what's wrong with you? You mean you don't have control? Just buck up and show control. The patients who have this know what it's like. They know how their motivational system has been redirected. They know it's not normal to choose to use alcohol and drugs despite problems with your health, despite issues with your kids. And so we listen to our patients. We listen to what happens. We try to reconcile that with what fabulous scientists from NIAAA and NIDA and others have come up with. We try to put them together. And this definition we've worked on for over 4 years. A few of us have sort of taken it to our counselors and our patients and said, what do you think of this? And they go, wow, that sounds like it's me. That sounds like my patient. This thing sort of fits. And so it sounds like Woody liked it when he read it. And I think it's because it does a fair job of taking some very complex topics and trying to package them in a way that, you know, it's not easy to understand, but it's possible to understand. And we hope we're doing a service by putting this out there and putting this on our website.
My guys say all of the time, you know, I've been in a lot of programs, but this is the first time I've ever heard it put this way. I say, which way? Well, that's how it is. I say, yeah, I know. Like Dr. Miller just said, they can relate to it. They, once it's explained in a language that they can understand and it's framed in the context of what they have already experienced and lived through, then it makes sense to them. And when things start making sense to people, then they start engaging, you see. So you have to meet them at the level where they are and understand that. And also, I understand the cause, you see. Not that it's just some abnormal behavior that just showed up out of the blue. No, it's generated from the brain and from the rest of the body. I just found maybe a year ago that the digestive system and the brain cells come from the same clump of cells, and that there's a way of recognizing in the digestive system or the solar plexus different feelings that then are understood by the brain as being certain kinds of cravings. So in essence, what we're saying almost is like we got two brains. We got one here and one up here. We got a cognitive awareness, but we have a visceral awareness also that doesn't come out in terms of labels or words or things like that, but shows up in different kinds of feelings and moods and things. So that opened up a whole nother area that I was taking a look at and talking to people about. It's pretty fascinating once you start looking at it.
We're about to take a break, and I'm going to encourage listeners here to join us at 410-319-8888 as we examine what the American Society for Addiction Medicine has put out with their new study, and looking at addiction as a brain disorder, and what that does, what that means, how it means to change our perspective on addiction, on treatment of addiction, and much more. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts. 410-319-8888. Woody Currie is here, clinical and associate executive director of the Baltimore Station. And Dr. Michael Miller, I understand you have to run. Is that right?
Yeah, well, you know, if we haven't had a chance for listener call-in, let me stick around for maybe a phone call and be able to respond if I might. And then thank you so much for doing this program. We can't thank you enough. You're doing a great public service.
Well, thank you. We'll keep you around then. We'll be right back with Dr. Michael Miller and Woody Currie. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555, or you can log on to steinershow.org at our website. Click on the banner of the Maryland Housing and Community Development Department, and all the information will be there as well. We are talking about a new report that has come out from the American Society for Addiction Medicine. It's saying that addiction is a brain disorder. It is not a disease. It is not, it's a brain disease, a brain disorder. It could change the entire nature and way that we look at what causes addiction and also how to treat addiction. So it raises a lot of questions we're going to tackle with in the next half an hour with your help at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Because we spend a lot of time in this country locking people up or punishing people for their addictions, whatever those things are, whether we mock them in the press, mock them on reality shows, or put them behind bars. So we want to hear your thoughts on how this might change your attitudes towards addiction, maybe a dozen, what you think about how it should change the way we deal with addiction. Many of you who listen to the show have fought your own addictions and have talked to us about those things and your own viewpoints on that. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We'll get these calls coming in at 410-319-8888. Woody Curry is in the house, clinical and associate director of the Baltimore Station, where he's been running a therapy community for how many years now?
I don't know.
Long time.
Yeah. 15.
15 years that has been based on this model, has based his work on this model. We're talking with Dr. Michael Miller, past president of the American Society for Addiction Medicine that put out this study. He's also medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at the Rogers Memorial Hospital at Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We're going to come to these calls coming in now to get you on the air with us so you can join in with Dr. Miller and Woody Curry. 410-319-8888. Let's go to our first caller, and Janice, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Janice.
Welcome.
And hi, Mark. I'm listening to your segment on addiction. And my question is, as a black woman, 49 years old, in a relationship with a man that does have, I believe, alcohol addiction, and we have discussed it, and what I wanted to know is how could I really be of help to him?
Why don't we start with Dr. Miller, then come over to Woody Curry. Doctor, go ahead.
Well, I thank you so much for posing that question. You're one of millions in a situation like this. And I know you want to help him, and I'm going to address that. But the first thing that's on my mind is, what are you going to do to help yourself? You need to keep a focus on yourself through this thing, because if you get wrapped up in all of his stuff, it can really, really complicate your own psychology and your own functioning quite a bit. So the helping organization that doesn't cost a penny, that's been around for decades, is Al-Anon. And Al-Anon can teach you a lot, not only about how to respond to a loved one in your life who has a problem with alcohol or drugs, but how you can respond to your own inner feelings and the reactions you have to the situation. Now, what we say in our line of work is, don't enable, and what does that mean? It means don't interpose yourself between a person and the natural consequences of their behavior. So when you say what you can do to help, the most helpful thing you can do is not be, quote, over-helpful, and to set some appropriate limits on what you do. And if he is doing something that is leading him to feel sick, he's got to feel sick and maybe go to his own doctor about it. If he is having trouble getting to work on time, don't call in for him and make excuses and say he had car trouble and enable him with his job. Let whatever natural consequences of these behaviors, let them happen to him, because those are things that can help him get some good data to reflect on to possibly change his behavior. If we can get back to that definition of addiction we've been talking about, it's about motivational hierarchies. And the thing is that our motivational hierarchies are really twisted around when we get involved with addiction. And the number one thing in our becomes our drug, that be a metaphor, or quote-unquote our drug. What needs to motivate the person with addiction is the things that should motivate all of us, our loved ones, responsibilities, our jobs, fine arts, what have you. And so you have somebody the ability to experience the pluses and the minuses of life in order to reduce some of the power that this addictive substance or behavior has over them. So, you know, one of the things you can do to help your loved one is, in some extent, get out of the way and let the natural course of things happen for him. That would be my response. What do you say?
Same thing. One of the thing that I see as a primary motivator for the person that's using is pain. And when I get calls like this all of the time, and my response is the same as Dr. Miller's. The person that's calling me needs help right then and there. That's the person that's on the line. And my advice is the same, that you have to look out for yourself and let the consequences of the person's behavior weigh on that person. And those are the things that's going to motivate that person to go and seek some help. But you get in and you try to do what traditionally people do when they see people that they care about or they love is try to ease the pain and make excuses and help them over. It doesn't work. You're enabling, and then you wind up finding out you're in some kind of codependent relationship where both people are caught up in the same process. So I basically give the same advice that you can't enable the person, and maybe with the best intentions, that's what you've been doing. But I'd suggest you do some things to try to help yourself, and that's like Al-Anon and places where people who are in relationships with people with addictions learn how to protect themselves and to look out for themselves.
Folks, you can join us here at 4 Minute. Thank you so much for that call, Janice, and good luck with your life and what you're going through. 410-319-8888 will come these next few calls coming in here as we talk about the new studies about addiction and those study saying that addiction is a brain disease, a brain disorder. 410-319-8888. As we go get ready for these next callers to bring them in, one of the things that I wonder what both of you think this means in terms of how we might create a discussion in this society about how to address people who have addictions, and it's almost some serious addictions that can lead to what is illegal behavior. All right, if somebody is busted for cocaine, heroin, whatever they have, or somebody has is arrested for drunk driving and is an alcoholic, or any number of things that could lead an addicted person to be involved in the legal system, and we know that a huge number, majority of people who are incarcerated are addicted in one form or another, and that addiction is often at the bottom of the root of some of the criminal behavior that people are involved in. So, how does this change for you all? What the discussion should be, and how you recreate the discussion or move the discussion with this study with our legal system, which is where many addicts end up and are confronted with.
Well, I have a lot of clients that come from drug court.
Yeah, you do.
And just about everybody that I've had the experience of being a therapist or treating, most drug addicts have some type of legal problem, and that's one of the symptoms of the addiction that's out of control or what drives it. And I think in Maryland anyway and in Baltimore City that they have a drug court that recognizes this. And I have a lot of clients that come to the program because it's long-term in lieu of going to jail and receive treatment. And my drug court clients respond. I mean, they have the same problem. Now, the means by which that they get there is just incidental, but I'm still dealing with people that have the same problem. So I treat them the same way. And the results I get are basically the same. I get just as good a response from the drug court clients as I do from the veterans or anybody else.
And Michael Miller?
Well, I would say that it's an absolute misconception to believe that you can effectively punish away addiction. And so locking people up does not treat much of anything. And so it is okay if society wants to say what's approved and what's not approved and what's sanctioned and what will end up having you in court. Society can do that. But I want to give a big amount of credit to the American Psychiatric Association, which actually developed diagnostic criteria for psychiatric disorders and even substance use disorders. And they have their criteria called the DSM, and they're coming out with a new version of it in a couple of years. And in the substance use disorders area, it used to be considered that if you kept using despite problems in your life, including legal problems, well, it wasn't normal. Most people would conform their behavior if they were facing problems with their family or their job or their legal status. They're taking that whole legal thing out of the DSM-5, the next edition. They're saying whether something's legal or illegal is not in the medical domain. It's not in the psychiatric domain. We're not going to say a criterion of an illness is whether you've broken a law. We're going to say that we need to look for other criteria. And I think that's just part of a big picture of realizing that we need to medicalize these conditions to some extent. At least we need to not just have a criminal view of them and view them all through the prism of what's illegal, who should we lock up, who should we not lock up. Lock up is not a solution.
Now, we had someone called in but didn't want to come on the air live. We have some other people calling in who do want to come on. But her question was, What about the intersection of mental illness and addiction? She knows people who use drugs to treat mental illness, for example. And how does this feed into that this study and what this says about addiction? Dr. Miller?
Well, my cell phone seemed like it was breaking up a bit, and if it is, I'm really apologizing.
No, it's fine. We hear you clearly.
But one of the factors that's been known to affect the severity of how addiction manifests itself, and also the ease or complexity with which somebody goes through recovery, is the coexistence of psychiatric disorders. Now, some people claim that the presence of what's called dual diagnosis, mental illness with addiction together, is like 80%. Other people say, oh, no, it's only like about 20%. It's somewhere in the middle, and the problem is the definitions of substance use disorder and mental disorder can vary in different studies. But psychiatric issues certainly are important, and somebody's depression, anxiety, panic disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, somebody's even anorexia or bulimia or psychotic disorder can lead them back to substance use and can be a trigger of relapse or a function in relapse. So these topics are relevant, but the important part in this definition is that addiction is a primary illness. It's not due to mental illness. You don't have addiction because you have depression. You don't have addiction because you have anxiety or panic. And actually, you don't have addiction because you have a bad marriage, a bad boss, a bad neighborhood, a bad back. You have addiction because you have addiction. It's a primary illness. So we talk about it being primary, chronic, a brain disease. But more than just the brain, a biopsychosocial spiritual disorder, it's a lot of things. But when you bring up the topic of mental illness, we should not think that somebody's psychiatric condition explains all of their substance use, that the solution to this addiction is to go see a psychiatrist, and that alone is the solution. I'm a psychiatrist, an addiction to an addiction medicine doctor, and I know that psychiatric treatments are really important for certain things, and addiction approaches are really important for addiction. So, before I leave the program, I want to remind the listeners that what we're talking about is a new definition of addiction, and if they want to read about it, it is www.asam.org. And right on the front page, we're highlighting this new release document. And we just wish your listeners well. And again, I want to thank you for inviting me to be on your program today, okay?
Well, I appreciate you being part of it, and that'll be on our website. Thank you so much for being with here.
Thank you, Dr. Miller.
You bet. Okay. Nice talking to you, Woody. Nice meeting you all over the radio.
Thanks.
Take care now. Woody.
I treat co-occurring disorders, which means that a person, like Dr. Miller said, have psychiatric or psychological diagnosis along with the addiction. So I have to treat both of these disorders, diseases, simultaneously, because if not, one's going to sabotage the other. But then I also have to have an awareness that a lot of things that are diagnosed as psychological or psychiatric problems may just be part of a paradigm or a thing that we call post-acute withdrawal syndrome. A lot of the withdrawal symptoms from substances can be misdiagnosed as being psychiatric symptoms. I've had a person that was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and then when I looked at it more closely and looked at his history, I was asking the question as to when he was diagnosed, was he using drugs? And he said, yeah, cocaine. So I'm looking at a cocaine-induced psychosis rather than a diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia. I have to look at that in the context of the entire person and treat both things simultaneously. But I definitely don't want to take a withdrawal symptom and label it as a psychiatric, or even though it appears that way and I would have to intervene the same way, but rather than being a permanent diagnosis, it's just part of the addiction. And then sometimes it's not. A lot of questions that I ask, were you diagnosed prior to you starting to use drugs or after you were using drugs, to try to see if I can differentiate between whether it's a symptom of the addiction or withdrawal, or whether it's a separate diagnosis. Because like Dr. Miller said, addiction is a primary diagnosis. It's not associated with anything else, but you can have something else that, if not treated along with the addiction, will make both diagnosis more pronounced. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense to me. And let's go back to our listeners and see what they're thinking, because addiction takes all forms, and some of it's drugs, some of it's eating, some of it, there are many things that people
do. Yeah, but it's all centered in the reward system of the brain.
Right. 410-319-8888, and I kind of question the 10% number I hear about addiction. I think addiction is much larger than 10% in our country.
Well, that's the ones they can count.
Yes, 410-319-8888. LaVon, you're on the air.
Okay, yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call, and hi to your guests. I wanted to ask a question about whether or not is there addiction to food, and what's the difference between so much habit or addiction? Because, you know, I have a food problem, and it seems like certain foods, they are triggers. I try to kind of like wean myself off of them. Sometimes I have headaches, sometimes I don't. Sometimes it's just I feel like I just, whatever it is that I want, I'm gonna have it. So is there serious addictions to food and the kinds of treatments that are available for that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question.
Well, like Dr. Miller and I were saying, it's the reward centers of the brain and what gives a person satisfaction, and it doesn't necessarily have to be drugs. I mean, it's there's a feature of addiction. Now, I'm not talking about drug use, even though that's part of drug use. A couple of things. Automaticity, when the response to cues from the environment is more or less automatic rather than a conscious decision. Habituation, which is performing the same behaviors over an extended period of time until they become second nature. And then there's that reward that a person gets, salience, that we call it, that whatever the person's doing is the answer to whatever discomfort or dissonance in their emotional state that they're experiencing. And the cessation of that particular emotional state is dependent on some type of activity or some kind of indulgence to satisfy it. So it all falls into the same kind of paradigm.
But there are places that people who feel that they have a food disorder can go to? Do they exist in this community?
12-step programs cover the whole gambit of behaviors. I mean, you know, Shoppers Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, those principles in 12-step program more than like most of the time work with just about any kind of.
LaVon, did I answer your question?
That's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Thank you, love. Thank you for joining us. 410-319-8888. And Alan, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening, everyone.
Thank Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. Thank you. I have a question regarding love addiction. What is the actual, recovering steps? I've been doing research on it, and it's not quite the same as alcoholism or drug addiction, but it is an addiction. What are the steps, or what is some advice that you can give regarding recovery? And is it really a well-defined addiction?
It's a good question. Woody.
Well, you know, I don't want to sound facetious and cynical, but first of all, what's your definition of love? Now, you see, before you start saying love addiction, what's the definition for love?
Wait. Go ahead. Alan, you
see what I'm saying? You got to define the problem.
I absolutely agree with you, but in doing research, because this title was given, and from what it was told was you have some sort of emptiness that you're trying to substitute for. For instance, if you have a parent that was emotionally absent during childhood, you tend to gravitate to the same character as an adult in a spouse, mate, or relationship. And this becomes an addiction because you have this thrive for the rush of a new relationship. And that's what I'm saying. The definition of it is, you know, when you have a broken heart, you cry. When you have withdrawals from someone's absence, I thought it was normal, but now it's a title. It's an addiction.
Not
Woody,
necessarily.
I
it's Woody? Dependency. What you're describing is dependency.
Right.
And there's a difference between love and dependency. Love is free. I mean, love does not require possessiveness, dependency, having, holding, all of that. Now, relationships is a whole nother ball game. You can become emotionally attached or dependent upon a certain individual because being with that person causes changes in the brain. You get this big uptake of dopamine and serotonin, which makes you feel whole and good and well, and then you say that that's that person that's doing that, when actually it's your perception and your reaction and your desire that's triggering you to act on that, which in turn releases these chemicals and you feel good and whole and everything. And so you become dependent on another person, place, or thing as being the object of your addiction, when in actuality it's the needs that you aren't supplying for yourself that causes you to look outside for things to do what you need to learn to do.
And what you could call that as well is something that, which you describe as dependency.
Mm-hmm.
That people, for a lot of things that happen to people as children, can give rise to emotional dependency.
That's where the memory part of this addiction comes from. We spend our whole life synthesizing experiences that we've had or didn't have as children.
Right.
So we seek the same type of satisfaction that we felt as children via the same type of interactions and the same processes. We got unconditional love as a baby. The brain remembers that. It doesn't remember in words or what you call it. It remembers the feeling that went along with that. So we are not even conscious that we're seeking that same experience in relationships for the rest of our lives. But when we get older, we find out that those kind of things have conditions on them. It's not unconditional anymore. And that's where the problem comes in, you see. So, but we don't see that.
Well, Woody Cray will be back here in a few more weeks, and we will continue our conversation about addiction. I have some ideas about where we might take it, because I think we live in a hugely addictive society. And I think a lot of there are a great many more addictions than we think about in this addictive world we live in the United States of America, on this planet Earth. And I'm Woody Curry. Thank you so much for being with us once again.
Thank you, Mark.
I want you to be able to go to steinershow.org, and you can link on to the ASAM website and see the study for yourself. Dr. Michael Miller was our other guest during the course of the hour. Appreciate you all calling in and writing in and making this show what it was this hour. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back from this break and come back to the top of the hour, we're going to be joined by comedian Michelle and her Gold Diggers Project in Park Heights. Very fascinating what they're doing there. So, Woody Curry, brother, thank you. Good to have you in the studio once again.
Thanks, man.
Don't go away. We'll be right back.